from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts judges are under fire amid calls to keep more people in jail. Also this hour, hundreds of newsrooms around the country join the Boston Globe in speaking out against President Trump's criticism of the media.
They can make anything bad because they are the fake, fake, disgusting news.
Some say the media need to push back. Others say this is a PR stunt that'll backfire. And today, we remember the Queen of Soul. Aretha Franklin died today at the age of 76. That's coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Massachusetts judges are coming under fire from some high-profile officials who say the judiciary needs to be tougher on criminal defendants. Newly appointed Boston Police Commissioner William Gross said this week that judges are allowing repeat offenders out on the streets.
We are sick and tired of when we make arrests. Several of the individuals, it's their third and fourth time with a firearm offense. I'm going to tell you right here and now, stay away orders and ankle bracelets do not work.
His comments came after a triple shooting in Mattapan that left one person dead. We should point out no arrests have been made in that case. And then the president of the Massachusetts Major City Chiefs of Police Association suggested that judges' records should be reviewed every 5 years. And Governor Baker this week said there should be more dangerousness hearings, which he says would allow judges to keep more people in custody.
Under Massachusetts state law, there are very narrow categories for which you can pursue a dangerousness hearing. I think we need to broaden those.
So our question right now is, what role does the judiciary play in all this? And how do these calls square with the efforts to reduce mass incarceration in Massachusetts and to reform the criminal justice system? Well, joining us to talk about this is WBUR's legal analyst, former federal judge Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
Also on the line with us is retired Judge Isaac Borenstein, a Suffolk University law professor who was a judge in Massachusetts for 22 years. Hello, Judge Borenstein.
Nice to see you. Nice to be on. Nice to hear you.
Okay, first off, I want to go to you, Judge Borenstein, because these comments are very pointed against state judges. And so when you hear comments like those of Boston Police Commissioner William Gross, who says that judges need to do something so people do not get back out on the street, what's your first reaction?
That the commissioner certainly has a First Amendment right to express his opinion, but unfortunately, what he's asking judges to do is to make what I would call a political decision, or to put judges in the role other than that what they take an oath to do, which is to carry out, apply the law to the facts before them. It is not the role of a judge to respond to public policy issues like this, and I understand the concern of the commissioner. He has every right to be concerned for the public safety, but I think he's confusing the role of the judiciary. We take an oath to apply the law to the facts before us. We are not prophets. We're not clairvoyant. We can't predict what somebody's going to do or not do. If I can also say, to his credit, I would say that Governor Baker at least had it a little more accurately, which is he at least addressed that if there are going to be more dangerousness hearings, if the law is going to be broadened, it really is not up to judges, but it's up to the legislature to do that. And at least he was much more on point. But putting judges in a position of fearing that somehow they're going to be impeached or there are going to be efforts to review their records every 5 years, I think, confuses the role of judges versus the executive and the legislative.
Hmm. Nancy, I want to go to you because this isn't the first time that we've been hearing this. It seems like this has been sort of increasing this year. Last month, the Fall River Superior Court judge was criticized for lowering bail for a man who, when he was out, was then chased by police and resulted in a fatal car crash. And then in June, some lawmakers got together and said they wanted the legislature to intervene after a judge in Salem sentenced a man convicted of dealing heroin to probation and didn't give him jail time. So Nancy, what's happening here? Why are judges getting all the heat right now?
Well, I mean, part of it is, with all respect, is the media, which is that you cover those cases. You don't cover the success. You don't cover the guy who the judge put on an alternative to incarceration program and succeeded. Mm-hmm. So we only cover the failures. And in addition, it is easiest to dump on judges. What is troubling about the commissioner's comment is that he doesn't know who the people were who did this shooting. For all we know, it was a failure of policing, a failure of probation, a failure of schools. There are any multiple failures, but the problem is that we seize on judges because they are the most transparent actors, and it becomes essentially legislation by anecdote, which is, with all respect, even Governor Baker is saying, one of the things we know, and I know it from the federal side, is that longer sentences, we were sending people away 15, 20-year mandatory minimums, longer sentences had absolutely no impact on the amount of guns and gun violence in our streets. Full stop, and researchers have proved that. Gun violence is essentially a complicated phenomenon. I would venture to say if you went to any school in Boston and you asked the kids if they know where the guns are, they will. This is a more complicated phenomenon for which judges are part responsible, I suppose, but partly police, schools, social services, etc. It is outrageous to go back to longer sentences when we know they have not worked.
Hmm. And I wonder if you think that part of what might be a factor here is frustration by police because of the increasing tensions that police are facing in the community. Do you understand my question?
Yes, there are frustrations, but the frustrations, one of the things that we know, for example, is that what has worked in the past was when the police work with the community and the schools to think about the causes of gun violence, to think about how to address it. And sending people away for a long time, it really has not worked and does not work. And if in fact, all that it does is it fills our jails with black and brown people again, who return to communities essentially without skills, without jobs, much worse off. So we can't be going down this road again because it is really a dead end.
And it comes as we just completed criminal justice reform in the state legislature, which was done in part to reduce mass incarceration and recidivism. So I'm wondering, Judge Borenstein, what do you make of some of the reasons why you think this is happening right now?
Well, actually, I'm going to disagree. I don't think this is anything new. I think the history of an independent judiciary is there will be constant tension, disappointment, disagreement, and criticism of judges. This is nothing new. It may go up and down at different times, but it is part of history that judges make judgment calls, and if they do it in good faith, as overwhelmingly judges do, day to day, hundreds of times, as Judge Gertner says, and we don't hear about the successes, there's going to be disappointment and tension, and we are easy to point the finger to. So part of this is just kind of surfing through it and understanding that people have a right to criticize us, and if you're going to be a judge, you're going to get criticized. As long as we do what we're supposed to do, which is take an oath to apply the law to the facts before us, there will be criticism. Not everybody's going to like it. So I disagree with the fundamental notion that somehow this is more recent or more. What is more recent is that you're getting the executive branch in Washington and in other places attacking judges, I think, in ways that I don't think I've ever seen before on the basis of the judge's race or ethnic background. That is new. But the criticism of judges for decisions that we make, that's part of the turf.
And Governor Baker's call to expand dangerousness hearings so judges might be able to hold more people. Your thoughts on that, Judge Borenstein?
Well, at least I disagree with him fundamentally on the policy. I don't think we need to expand it. But at least what he got right is the role of judges, and it's not for us to amend the statute. That's for the legislature and for the executive to enforce it. But I happen to disagree. I think, you know, part of the criminal justice reform recently is an effort to hold less people on bail and to use bail less as a hammer to get people to plead guilty, perhaps to put pressure on them.
Mm-hmm.
So I have, and for other reasons, I disagree with it. But at least he points the finger at the right place, which is amend the law if that's what you'd like to do.
I just want to bring up a comment that we spoke with State Senator William Brownsberger earlier today. He's chair of the Judiciary Committee, and he talks about this issue of bail. And he says because of a Supreme Judicial Court ruling about bail, perhaps prosecutors should call for more dangerousness hearings. Let's listen.
Sometimes people say, well, why didn't the judge set a higher bail? Well, the judge didn't set a higher bail because they thought they set a bail that was sufficient to return the person to court. They didn't doesn't speak to the issue of dangerousness. So if prosecutors feel that somebody is potentially dangerous, it is on them, and it is their obligation, and it's their entire obligation to seek a dangerousness hearing.
Judge Borenstein, your reaction to Senator Brownsberger's comments, and then Nancy Gertner, I want to ask you as well.
I think that's a fair assessment. That is, I mean, the statute says on motion of the Commonwealth, that is on the prosecutor's request for a dangerousness hearing. And if a prosecutor doesn't request it, it really is not up to a judge to initiate it. And then the prosecutor bears a burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence, a high burden. And so, I, at least based on those limited remarks, I don't disagree with him about the role of prosecutors and of judges. Our bail statute is meant to reflect the history of bail, which is to reassure somebody's appearance as best as possible to come back to court, not to hold them because there's a perception of dangerousness unless you use the statute.
Nancy, your thoughts on Senator Brownsberger's comments?
No, I agree with Senator Brownsberger. It is not, again, there is a court criticism even in your question that somehow because of a Supreme Judicial Court decision we are doing something different. The Supreme Judicial Court was enforcing the Massachusetts state constitution. The federal constitution says the same thing. You don't take away someone's liberty unless they have been found guilty, except under limited circumstances. You don't prejudge a case. And the dangerousness concept, the dangerousness hearing, was one of those limited instances. But the prosecutor has a high burden to meet then, and he has a high burden because we don't believe in preventive detention in this country. Gee, I think you just shot someone, hence I will keep you in jail. No, you wait until there is a formal charge and the person is convicted. That's a constitutional issue. So there is a framework, if there is someone who can meet the dangerousness standard, that we have to follow. But the worst thing here is, and I thought we were past this, is, you know, legislation by anecdote, right? The three cases that you mentioned, including the most recent one, now we suddenly reform everything. No, we have to look at what's going on, why it's going on, who's doing it, and then start smart strategies to deal with it rather than the failed strategies of the past.
And you think we're just actually being reactionary here and going back to doing that sort of legislating, particularly on crime, by reacting to crime and making policy that way?
Right, and especially violent crime, by the way. I mean, one of the people have studied violent crime and studied them in Boston, and many of the people who are violent were themselves victim of violence in the home, in schools. And we have to, in order to deal with it, we have to deal with it in a meaningful way. Locking people up didn't work.
Judge Borenstein, I'm wondering, you know, you were a judge for decades. Did you ever have to make a decision, or did you ever make a decision that you look back on and in hindsight, you really regret it?
I don't know any judge who comes on the bench that has a heart, a soul, and a brain that does not reflect on things we have done. We do. We're human. But we also, judges like Judge Gertner and others, think through decisions well before they make them, the tough decisions. We don't do it impulsively. We give it as much thought as we can so that we minimize the post-event regret. And you know what? What they say about 2020 hindsight, it's the ability to predict the past. And it's very easy for people after the fact to say, gee, I would have done it differently. The fact is what we need is good judges who are thoughtful and reflective before they make decisions, and yes, who are human and sometimes think back about decisions. Heaven help us, the number of decisions that have resulted in wrongful convictions being reversed for people who we would have forgotten and said, well, it's over, it's final, let's not even look at it again.
Okay.
So thank God we have that ability to look back sometimes and say, you know what, I may have been wrong about that decision.
Retired Judge Isaac Borenstein, a Suffolk University law professor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also, WBUR's legal analyst, former federal judge Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The legendary Aretha Franklin died today at her home in Detroit. She had been battling pancreatic cancer. Aretha Franklin was 76 years old. We want to spend some time today remembering the Queen of Soul, and we have a few guests joining us to do that. Renee Graham, who's columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Renee, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Deborah.
Also with us, Sue O'Clair, Director of Marketing and Communications for the Cabot in Beverly. She worked with Aretha Franklin in your role as former Director of Public Relations for the Newport Jazz Festival, Folk Festival, and Rhythm and Blues Festival.
Yes.
Sue,
hi.
Thanks for coming in.
It's great to see you.
So, Renee, let's start with you. We're going to talk about specific songs. We're going to hear more of this lovely music in just a couple of minutes. But first, tell us what Aretha Franklin meant to you personally.
You know, Aretha Franklin has been there, it feels like, my entire life. I was 5 years old the first time I heard Aretha Franklin because my mother was a big Aretha Franklin fan. And so I was used to listening to and seeing those, you know, 45s on the Atlantic label, that red and black label, playing sort of at all times of the day and night in my household. The voice just moved me. It was a church voice, but it was a church voice in a secular setting. The difference, though, was that she never sort of scraped off she didn't try to tone down her voice for pop radio. You know, what you got was an Aretha Franklin voice in every kind of setting of music. And that was what made it really remarkable. It was just the most extraordinary voice, the tenderness, the ecstasy, the power. The glory, there was just nothing else quite like Aretha Franklin's voice.
Hmm. Why do you think she had the staying power, too, that she had? I mean, we're talking a career that spanned several decades, right? I mean, she really was able to maintain that powerful voice and career through the decades. Why was that, Renee?
You know, talent survives. You know, I think that's a big part of it. And, you know, she was also this kind of bigger-than-life personality. You know, even when she wasn't putting out hit records, she always stayed in the public consciousness. And, you know, she might be in an award show. She would do an anthem at a sporting event. It didn't really matter. You wanted to see what Aretha was going to do, what Aretha was wearing, you know, how she would throw her fur off. You wanted to listen to her play piano. There was so much going on there that, I mean, look, she was one of the first, you know, single-name superstars, Aretha. Mm-hmm. You know, she was the first woman in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, that is the kind of power of Aretha Franklin, and that's why she had a career that was sustained for 50 years. And, you know, 50 years from now and 50 years beyond that, people will still be talking about Aretha Franklin.
Right. You know, it's probably the question that no one ever wants to answer, but everyone is always asked. Okay, favorite? You have a favorite time that you remember of Aretha? I want to ask Sue O'Clair this question, too. Favorite?
Well, when she came out with Respect.
Right.
That was an amazing song.
Right.
That was huge.
In the 60s.
Was it the
1967.
60s? Yeah.
It was 1967, yeah.
And it almost was like a women's liberation, you know, her sexuality was like bigger than life, you know, and it was the time of revolutions, you know.
Right.
And to sing about that was amazing.
I just wanted to quickly interject, you know, one of the main things about Respect was that was an Otis Redding song. Hmm. Otis Redding had written and recorded that song a year before. It was Aretha's arrangement and her whole, you know, the spelling of the word and the sakatumis at the end of that song that made it so memorable. And, you know, Otis Redding, shortly before his death, would joke, you know, that girl stole my song. Because he knew that song would never belong to him again after he heard Aretha's version.
So this is the perfect excuse for us to play a little, right? We need to hear a little bit. Let's hear. Okay, I want to share my favorite performance of Aretha because I've watched this online so many times. The 2015 Kennedy Center Honors of Aretha with her rendition of You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. Everybody must know this by now, right, Renee Graham? You know this,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Carole King's in the crowd going crazy. President Obama's moved to tears. And, of course, this is a great excuse to listen to some of that, too. Let's listen. How can you not get the chills just listening to that? Renee, why do you think this performance was special? I'm assuming you agree with me here.
You know, I mean, people kind of forget. You know, Aretha was there to honor Carole King, who wrote that song. And she came out in that very Aretha way. She's got this massive fur coat on. She sits down at the piano, and then she gets up, and she is just putting everything into that song, not just for herself, but to honor Carole King and to honor the Obamas who were also there because it was the Kennedy Center Honors and Carole King was being honored. I mean, it's like that thing. It's, you know, she closes the show, and if you were watching it in your living room, you were on your feet cheering. You were jumping up and down because, you know, at that point, you know, Aretha Franklin's in her 70s at that point. She's been doing this for over 50 years, and to give that kind of performance in front of that audience where you've got politicians and other artists, and you are wowing everybody. I can't think of many other people who could have pulled that off.
Right. You know, and I think this is probably a good time to bring up her work in the civil rights movement because this was very important to her. And she did a lot of work that she wasn't well known for, I think. Right, Renee?
You know, it's interesting. You know, Aretha Franklin was very plain about this. She called herself a singer and entertainer. She never called herself an activist. However, she was integral to the civil rights movement, not just because the movement, you know, adapted Respect, but because, you know, she marched with King. She sang at Martin Luther King's funeral. In the 1970s, when civil rights activist Angela Davis was in jail, Aretha Franklin offered to get, you know, bond her out. And she said, I don't care if it costs $100,000 or $250,000. Black people will be free. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are the things she did. And she did it in some ways kind of quietly. You know, she wasn't, you know, on TV always talking about it, but she just knew the work she had to do. And she went about her business and did it.
Sue O'Claire, as we said, you know, you worked for the Newport Festivals and you worked with Aretha Franklin. What was that like?
Oh, it was, for me, it was an amazing thrill and an honor. I adored her, and it was so exciting to have her at Newport.
Yeah.
And I have a couple funny stories.
Oh, sure. Well, that's what we want to hear.
Well, if we can possibly laugh at this time, it's a mix for me, you know.
Right.
But
you've got your tissue in the studio.
Yeah, I got the tissue ready here. But we were backstage at Newport. Renee was probably there one of those years, maybe not at that one. But I had a lot of people wanting interviews with her, and there was no word from her publicist, Barbara Shelley, before the festival, so we had to kind of wing it backstage. And then I finally made friends with her brother who handled these things, and he said, okay, you can only have six people, and they get one question each, and you run the show. Oh, great. Okay. So she comes off stage and goes into her trailer, and we're out there in 95-degree heat waiting because she's cooling off, quieting, you know, probably having a glass of wine or something. I don't know. And we're waiting and waiting and waiting, and then all of a sudden, Ruth Brown, the fabulous rhythm and blues singer who was also in the festival, walks up, and she's wearing a black bowler hat and a bright pink jacket and pants, and she's carrying a cane, and she's strutting, and Aretha must have seen her through the trailer window. All of a sudden, the door of the trailer opens, and there's Aretha in her underwear, in her bra and panties, going, "Hey, baby, come on in!" And Ruth says, "I'm coming, honey, I'm coming." So we're all like, you know, this was before cell phones and Instagram, so there's no photos of this, but we were all like, our eyes
Thank
falling
goodness.
Out. You know, and then it was another half hour while they visited, and then she finally came out, and she was gracious and wonderful. She answered all the questions. She was very sweet.
So not too much
very
diva.
Sweet. No, not, she's not a diva.
Yeah.
No. I think that's a bad word. You know, I think people, artists, work so hard, and the tour and the schedules they have are horrible. Yeah. I mean, that you have to take into account what they're dealing with,
right,
you know?
Right. Why do you think she's such an icon?
Well, she's American history. You know, her music is historic, and I think she's probably the greatest soul star of the 20th century and into the 21st century as well. She broke down all the barriers. Everybody loved Aretha.
Right.
You know, she comes from the black church, but everybody, white, brown, black, everybody loved her.
Mm.
And her career stuck, like Renee was just saying, for many, many decades,
yeah.
Unlike many of today's artists who are here for a while and then the record label drops them and then they get someone else.
Right.
You know, there's never anybody else like Aretha going to happen here.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Renee, why do you think she's an icon? And we'd like to go out with your final thoughts to share as we remember Aretha Franklin today.
You know, I think it's very much what Sue said. She was American history. I mean, she spanned so many decades of this country, and there she was. And she was, you know, not to be cliche, but she was that soundtrack. You know, people could relate to where they were at a certain time when Aretha Franklin had a particular song out. And it was also the depth of the songs. It was always more. And people forget, she wrote songs. She arranged songs. She was a beautiful piano player. I mean, it was all these kinds of things. It was just, you know, and on top of that, you know, in my mind, the most rapturous voice in music history.
All right. Renee Graham, associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Deb.
Sue O'Clair, Director of Marketing and Communications for the Cabot in Beverly. She worked with Aretha Franklin when she worked for the Newport Festival. Sue, thanks for coming in as well.
Thank you for having me.
We'll go out with a little bit of Aretha music as well. Stay with us. Coming up, journalists around the country come out against the president's criticism of the news media, but some say this is going to backfire. We'll take your calls. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Today, more than 300 media outlets around the country joined forces to promote freedom of the press. The Boston Globe led this effort in response to attacks on the press by President Trump.
A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people.
The Globe's editorial today is titled, "Journalists Are Not the Enemy." And for more on this, we're joined by Linda Pizzuti-Henry. She's managing director of the Boston Globe. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Also with us in studio, John Carroll, a professor of journalism at Boston University and WBUR's senior news analyst. Great to have you as always.
Good to be here.
And listeners, we want to hear from you on this topic as well. What do you think of this effort by the media to push back against the president's comments? Did your local paper participate? And do you agree with those who say that this is nothing more than a PR stunt that plays into the president's narrative? Call us with your thoughts at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-8255. 1-800-723-TALK. You can also send us a tweet. We are at Radio Boston. So, Linda, let's start with you. What was the thinking behind, you know, calling for news organizations to get together here and publish editorials about freedom of the press?
Thank you. So this idea started with our within our editorial board. Specifically, Marjorie Pritchard had this idea, and the editorial board got behind it, that there is a consequence to this increased rhetoric. And we want it. We have a choice. We either stay silent and absorb it, or you respond. And so we decided that we wanted to respond, and we reached out to other newspapers saying, hey, we're going to respond to this. Would you like to join us? And the response was really overwhelming. It started slowly and it snowballed. And we really wanted to make sure that it was a voice from voices of newspapers from around the country, but in their own words. Mm. Because what a free press means here in Boston and how the press serves this community is different from how it serves a community in Boise, for example. And the we ended up with, the last count is 380, but we're not done counting.
Really? So 380 newspapers around the country.
News organizations.
News organizations around the country have published editorials in support of a free press. What are you hearing? What kind of reaction are you getting today? We did hear that the Senate passed a resolution, the U.S. Senate passed a resolution.
Right? That was a fantastic response, that there was a response by the president. And this wasn't something that is aimed. This is not an attack against the president. This is an affirmation of what the role of a free press is. And so the reactions were, well, there are two different reactions. There's what did other editorials say, and it's just so remarkable to read because the language that's used and, you know, in each news organization in their own words of how they, why they do what they do, you know, it's a reminder of the function of the press that's often taken for granted. Mm. And so the communities will, you know, some smaller weeklies will talk about how our kids are in the same school as your kids, and we care about the water and the roads and the traffic and the new restaurant opening just the same as you, and just sort of this moving away from the dehumanizing language to we're fellow Americans.
Right. So we should say that that Senate resolution basically condemns attacks on freedom of the press. So you've had some positive reaction, but of course you've had some not so positive reaction, including from the president himself. He's tweeting up a storm today, not surprisingly.
Yep,
but
I
just want to read a little bit of what he said. Quote, the Boston Globe, which was sold to the failing New York Times for $1.3 billion or $2.1 billion, was then sold by the Times for $1, and now the Globe is in collusion with other papers on free press. The president's angry. We get it, but basically he's saying, you know, the newspaper business, sort of saying, if I can paraphrase the president here, that the newspaper business isn't what it used to be. Globe's a leaner operation, which is true, and everyone joining forces here just proves that all the media are against him.
So it's an interesting definition of collusion because this was a very open and transparent initiative, and it wasn't designed to deceive anyone. It was a open and coordinated initiative for people to, again, use their own words. We are the free press, and this is what we do every day. So it is not collusion.
Okay.
It is also it did not sell for a dollar.
Okay. John Carroll, let's bring you into this conversation. What's your take on this editorial effort today?
Well, first of all, let me say that it's essential to, I think it's essential to fight back against any effort to marginalize or delegitimize the news media. And I think that this initiative is an interesting way to go about it. It's innovative, it's newsworthy, but it also comes with some baggage. And I think that that the 50% of Republicans who consistently in polls say the press is the enemy of the people, you know, they're not going to be swayed by this. And I don't think that they're the target, actually. Mm. But here are some of the things that they're saying on the right, just to give you an idea of how they react to this. One person said, this is great because it makes it easy for readers to make a list of which papers are fake news. There's another one who says that this is a reflection of the entitled belief by the news media that the First Amendment protects them from criticism. And so those are the reactions that are coming on the right. So there's that message that's going out as well. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of a pro-press, not anti-Trump effort is a really tough bank shot to make. Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, you look at the text of a number of these editorials today, and you know what you see is Donald Trump in a lot of them. And so that makes it all the more difficult to make this a positive initiative as opposed to something that is in opposition to Trump. Hmm. And then there's the narrative. I mean, the whole idea of collusion among these national
or at least
mainstream
collaboration,
media.
Right.
I mean, so they're aligned against Trump. I mean, you know, that this plays into that feeling.
Right. And so Linda, I'm just wondering if you want to talk about that a little bit. If maybe collusion is just a loaded word at this point, do you worry about playing into the president's narrative here that all the media are against him, maybe collaborating against him when everyone joins forces?
So, you know, the intended audience for this is really the people who are in these communities that are served by these journalists, by these different news organizations. Again, as a reminder, when you have this alternative narrative coming at you saying that it's fake news, that they're the enemy, these dehumanizing classifications that they're putting as a step back saying, hey, this is actually what we do and why we do it, and here's why it matters. And so do I think it plays into – no. Well, yeah, you know, we had – with the over 380, they came from red states and blue states. They came from small newspapers, mid-sized, large news organizations. It was a variety. There were a few that abstained, and some abstained for different reasons, and some were against it, and we published what – we linked to what they said as well, because this is a large course, but I, you know, anything can be twisted.
It's my understanding that there were some security threats received by the Globe today because of this, and security has actually been increased at the paper's offices. Can you talk about that at all?
I think that we are being careful right now, it's something that, you know, there is a consequence to hostile rhetoric against journalists, and you see it in different places, and that's one of the reasons why we're doing this. It is completely fine and normal to complain or to point out where journalism fails, what they didn't cover, what they should have covered more, what they obsessed over and shouldn't have, and the criticism like that is welcome and deserved, just like criticism for our leaders and our different people in power is deserved and warranted.
Right, but have you had to increase security?
We have.
Yeah,
we have.
Yeah, because of threats made because of this editorial drive.
We're being careful right now.
Okay. I want to go to some calls and remind listeners that we'd like you to join this conversation as well. What do you think of this effort of media outlets around the country joining forces and publishing editorials and talking about the president's attacks on the press? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Mark is calling from Arlington. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm disappointed by the mainstream media in general. They're fixated on attacking the president and not covering important news stories around the country, around the world. You know, if it's protest riots in Haiti or Iraq or Venezuela, it gets barely any mention. Instead, half the evening news is attacking Trump. And the press conferences are disgraceful. It's just reporters trying to needle the press secretary.
And so Mark, the important stories that you think are not being covered are things that are happening in Haiti and Venezuela, is that right?
Well, just around the world in general. Mm-hmm. It's the press has been obsessed with attacking Trump, and there's very little real news in the U.S. newspapers. There's a lot of important stories.
And what do you...
Another point is the media is sanitizing the news. If a criminal is arrested, it's taken out that the person is undocumented, if that's the case.
Hmm.
Or in the case of New Mexico and the kids in the compound, initial coverages made no mention at all of Islam, radical Islam or Muslim, even though the names were clearly
So, Mark, I'm actually just what we're talking about today is today's efforts by news organizations to join forces and say how they feel about these attacks on a free press. You're saying the press should be criticized, but that's not really what we're talking about today. We're talking about the press joining together to outline what they do and say why it's important. I'm assuming you disagree with that effort.
Well, yeah, because they're guilty of really not doing a good job, and they're deserving of criticism. Sure, they can say what they like, but they have the right to do that. But they're really not serving their readership and their viewers just by focusing on Trump.
John Carroll.
Yeah, so if I could jump in. If you look at the front page of the New York Times today, there is probably one story about Donald Trump, and there are seven stories about something else. This is the most media-rich environment that any society has ever lived in. And if you want to find out something about Haiti or Venezuela, it's pretty easy to go find it. Now, the question is, mainstream media, which is the media that people tend to share, you know, is that really doing justice to public service? And I think the answer is a lot of news organizations are. And one of the problems we have here, I think, in this whole rumpus that's going on over fake news and legitimacy, is that people are living in parallel information universes. And there's not enough crossover, and there's not enough of a shared experience of news and information and analysis. And that's why people are essentially incapable of having any kind of rational public discourse, because there are no mutually agreed upon facts to start out from and form a foundation. So I think that is as much of a problem as any internal and intrinsic problems that the news media have, which they have in abundance in many cases, but at least they are willing to address them. Mm.
I want to bring someone else into the conversation here. Another paper that decided to join this effort, and that was the Cape Cod Times. The editor-in-chief is Paul Pronovo, and he is on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, Paul.
Thank you. Greetings from sunny Cape Cod.
Oh, we wish we were there today. It's such a perfect beach day. So we're all jealous, but why did you think it was important for your paper to join this effort that was led by the Boston Globe?
Well, you know, quite honestly, we had a lot of discussion, not only among the Cape Cod Times, but we're part of Gatehouse Media and the papers here in New England. The editors talked about it. A few publishers were involved in the discussion as well. And it went back and forth a little bit. Some of the concerns were the reasons that you folks have articulated already, you know, worries that we're playing into the president's hand or the idea of collusion. And obviously we've already seen him take some of what happened today and use that as fodder for his freshest tweets today. So there was that sort of thought. But at the end of the day, we felt that it was far more important to be involved, and there was far more to gain than to lose, and that's why we decided to join.
And are you concerned at all? I mean, we're hearing about increased security at the Boston Globe, some threats today. Have you experienced any of that, or are you concerned about that, Paul?
Well, certainly I could understand why something like that would be with the Globe in that, first of all, they're much bigger than us. Secondly, they organize this effort, and so that's going to naturally put, unfortunately, a bullseye on them. For us, we're not concerned in particular about this, but quite honestly, any journalist could tell you that threats are nothing new, and we often get irate callers for any number of reasons, and you always have to vet whether or not that is something to just sort of hang up the phone and not worry about and never hear from again, or think, I wonder if that person's coming through the door next. And so that is always in the back of your mind. I wouldn't say for us down here, it's in particular today.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think you're hoping to accomplish mostly with this?
Well, you know, the thrust of our editorial, and again, you know, different editorial boards took different tacks with it. We kind of tried to lay it out twofold. One, we wanted to say quite clearly that not only are we not the enemy of the people, but we are the people. At a community journalism level, we're your neighbors, we're your friends, we're your family, we're the folks who coach your soccer team, we're the folks you see in the grocery store. You know, we are the same as everyone else around us. And I think that when you are able to humanize this business like that, it's an effective way to combat what has been a pretty vicious demonization of us. And you know, like anything, it's easy to take something in a vacuum and say, oh, this is bad. But when you know someone or know more of the ins and outs, it's harder to make that accusation. So we're hoping to humanize who we are as a profession, and specifically who we are down here. That, and then also to point out that not only is this damaging in a general way, and we tried to make it clear that this is not Trump versus us. There's a larger issue at stake here, and that's the basic social compact that we, our industry, has, where our job is to find the truth and to report it as fully and fairly as possible, and we're counting on our folks, our advertisers, our readers, to believe what we say. That basic level of credibility is vital to us as an industry, and it's vital to a democracy. And when you take chips at it, small chips, big chips, whatever, it's really damaging to the foundation of what we're all about and what our country is all about. So that was something we wanted to drive home, and hopefully we did.
Okay, I want to take some calls. Stephen is calling from the Seaport. Stephen, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm actually considering that the president's very lucky right now that it was only an editorial that the Globe decided to run. I think they should really have a headline saying "Lionest President Ever," and they should just do one complete paper with every falsehood he's had since the beginning of a campaign to current. And I guarantee you, there would be the biggest paper that they had, bigger than their Sunday Globe edition.
Okay.
And I also realize too that it's really not going to change anybody's mind who's a Trump fan. But what it will do is it's got to energize the Democratic side and the independents to actually go out from frustration. I mean, my head's ready to explode from frustration of these past few years of dealing with this particular president. There has to be something that we could do to get him out of office. And I think that would probably be
okay.
one of the ways
Well, hold on a second, Stephen, because I think you bring up a point here, and that is bias. Because sometimes when the president's talking about fake news, is it sort of shorthand for bias in a way, that he's feeling that there's a slant to particular stories that are against him in general, and that some papers might be deliberately trying to get him out of office, which is not the role of the press. Let's talk about bias a little bit. Linda.
I want to first say that the editorial by the Cape Cod Times is exactly that, and that was exactly the intention, and that the intended audience was the people within the communities who need to look at their local community paper as their local community paper that's serving them and is their neighbors and the humanization. So that you got it exactly right. In terms of this, you know, this brings up the really important differential between an editorial page and the news page, and the editorial board versus the rest of the newsroom. And what is done in the newsroom is as straight as they can. You know, they try really hard. Is it possible to be absolutely zero bias? You're the professor.
No, it's not possible.
No, it isn't possible.
But they do try, and I think you can acknowledge that and understand that we really put the opinion in the editorial page or with our columnists, and that the news stories are, you know, they are based on the facts.
Right, and nobody is objective, but the idea is to use objective methods to gather and disseminate the news. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. The other thing is this firewall between the editorial board and the newsroom is something that's very familiar to people in the news business, but not so much to people in the general public. So it was interesting. The San Diego Union-Tribune did an editorial, but then they had a full page to say how we restore faith in journalism. And that's one of the things that I think, because you look at what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, maybe 5-10% of newspaper readers actually read the editorials. Mm-hmm. So what happens tomorrow? And I think one of the things that can be very valuable is for newspapers to start on an education program to show their work, to explain to people, you know, how they operate and how they try to be as unbiased as they can. Mm-hmm. And if more people were aware of the actual mechanics of doing this, I think they would be the news organizations. It would be easier for them to fight off these charges. You know, fake news started out as fraudulent news made for political purposes or financial purposes. Now, fake news is just anything that Donald Trump doesn't like. Mm-hmm. So it's a meaningless term at this point. And I think that newspapers have to substitute something meaningful for that to convince the public.
I think you're exactly right. Explaining what journalists do from time to time is important.
Mm-hmm. I just want to, just briefly in the time we have left, there are some newspapers that did not do this. San Francisco Chronicle today wrote that one of its most important values is independence, so it doesn't go along with the crowd, right? So that there's an issue right there. Baltimore Sun says this just plays into the hands of Donald Trump and his thinking that all in the media are out to get him. So this wasn't a unanimous thing, but I just wonder at this point, Linda, final words here, Linda Pizzuti-Henry, do you think that you've accomplished really what you set out to do with this today?
I think that we have raised awareness for what the role and the value of journalism is, and we helped connect the news organizations to the communities that they served.
Okay. Linda Pizzuti-Henry, Managing Director of the Boston Globe, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Also, John Carroll, Professor of Journalism at BU and WBUR Senior News Analyst. John, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.